You know, years ago, my mother used to say to me, she'd say, in this world, Elwood, you must be, she always called me Elwood. In this world, Elwood, you must be oh so smart or oh so pleasant. Well, for years I was smart. I recommend pleasant.
As always, I'm Lindsay Wilkins, and today I'm actually really looking forward to this double because I finally get to introduce my one friend with a very sweet and salty double of 1950s Harvey and 1982's Basket Case. And who joined me for this very polar different double? He's a wonderful guy. You all know him because he is a regular on the Amazing Film Feast podcast, especially in the recent Suicide Squad episode he did with Matt and Mark Warner. It is the wonderful Ken Walker. Hey, how's it going?
Hey, I'm really doing well, Lindsay. I appreciate you having me back on, and I'm really excited to talk about both these movies.
No, I should have told you off mic, but I forgot to tell you, so I guess I'll mention it now. I know you do love Basket Case, but when I suggested it, I was half expecting you to write back and go, can we do something else?
Oh, no. When you pitched this one, because I'm not sure if people have heard on the Film Feast podcast, when we did an episode talking about my top five favorite movies, my favorite movie of all time is the Jimmy Stewart classic, Harvey. So I'm always down to talk about that.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, yes, that was a great episode. And when I pitched it, I had forgotten this was your favorite movie. I thought it was like three or four for some reason. And then I just re-listened to that show and went, oh, holy crap, this is actually Ken's favorite movie.
Yes, my number one favorite. And of course, I mean, I love Basket Case. It's just fun 80s trash. And, you know, it's funny, when we were just talking, I know you always love to pair sort of these wild pairings, but there's always some sort of connection between them. And, yeah, the connection I made is, yeah, our main character has his secret pal. And, yeah.
It is very much about the secret pal and whether that secret pal is a superhero or whether it's the supervillain. And this one is kind of obvious which is which. But no, I cannot wait to get into these doubles because there's actually a lot to dig into. This was a really fun double to watch. And then we can get into your love of Harvey and our love of Basket Case and my now love of Harvey, because I fell in love with Harvey. So
I'm so glad.
Cannot wait to get into this double feature. So with that, we might as well get into it. Now, Ken, if we were going to be sitting down in a theater and actually watching this, what would be the first movie trailer you would show in front of Harvey?
So the first one I'm listing off is actually, it's funny, because I'm not sure if you got a chance to watch this when I sent it to you, but it's Sony put out a modernized trailer for the other Jimmy Stewart classic, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
The gentleman will raise his right hand. You solemnly swear to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and that you will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that you take this obligation freely without purpose of evasion, and that you will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office upon which you are about to enter. So help you God. So help you God.
I do.
And go ahead.
Oh, no, I said, yeah, I did get to watch it. Yeah, it's, yeah.
it's really cool how they sort of did all the, like, you know, the modern trailer cliches of, like, the bwom sound effects to this dialogue from this Jimmy Stewart classic.
It's weird. There's a bit of a disconnect because they are trying to make it a modern trailer, but yet it is Mr. Smith goes to Washington, and it's just this, which is a very 1939 Capra movie. So no, it is a really fun trailer, and it's sort of got the best of both worlds, and of course with that amazing Jimmy Stewartness in the center of it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it's and my fiance Kelsey actually introduced me to that movie. I had never seen it until she showed it to me.
Oh wow! I only first saw it a couple of years ago. No, more than
same.
That. I was deciding, right, I'm going to learn about film history. I'll go through the AFI, and it's on the AFI list somewhere. And as we'll get into with Harvey, I love how Jimmy Stewart has gotten this kind of reputation as this kind of folksy kind of persona, which I think is yes, but I think there's always something under the surface. And with Mr. Smith, I think there's a raw anger in there that I don't hear people talk about enough, which I think it makes it really interesting.
Yeah, well, and my favorite Christmas movie is, cliched as it sounds, It's a Wonderful Life. And you sort of get a good mix there of, you know, Jimmy Stewart just being charming. I think that's the best word to describe him, is just a charming person. But he's also, when he sort of gets drunk and belligerent with his children, and when he just berates that poor teacher over the phone. So you get a good range there.
You really do, because he sort of, that was the first movie he made after coming back from the war. So you really got the sense that he's actually working out some stuff as well as the main character in that movie is trying to work out some stuff. And then you've got this kind of very hopeful movie in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, but it's got this kind of, I don't know, anger seething kind of, I don't know. He's a fascinating actor, which we'll get into, but that is a great, great trailer. My first trailer, I'm going for a movie from the 80s, but it is My Favorite Year, directed by Richard Benjamin from 1982.
It was the year Hollywood's greatest hero swashbuckled his way onto live TV and into Benji's life.
He's blasted!
Good God, it's Renfield.
I thought he was dead.
Swan better be at every rehearsal sober, or it's your neck.
They've asked me to stay with you and help you over some of the rough spots.
Like showing up?
That's one. Another is not passing out.
What sort of heroic idiot am I this time?
A musketeer idiot.
I read that on the airplane. Very funny. Very good.
I wrote that.
Did you? Bravo, Stan. Bravo.
Now, have you seen this before?
No, I haven't.
It's a really special movie. It only came back into circulation a couple of years ago. I think before that was hard to find. It's got Peter O'Toole, and I should have written the kid's name down. It's a young kid who's working at this television station in the 1950s, kind of when TV's just coming up. And he has to babysit for a day this kind of aging matinee, kind of an Errol Flynn kind of type played by O'Toole, and has to keep him behaved before he goes on live. So he's not allowed to drink, he's not allowed to do anything. And of course, this is Peter O'Toole. So he's going to attempt to do every single one of those things. And it's just this
kind of... probably at the same time.
At the same time. I mean, yes. I mean, there's a reason why Peter O'Toole could act amazingly drunk on screen, because he usually was drunk in real life. He was one of the great real-time drinkers. But he's super charming in this, because it is about this guy having this amazing adventure with this kind of mythical figure, or this aging mythical figure who's not in his prime anymore. I guess it's sort of back in the day when movie stars would slum it by going on TV. But it's a really sweet movie, and I'd really recommend it. And the trailer's, it's got that kind of vibe of the trailer, so.
Fantastic. Peter O'Toole is, I remember, I think it was like a Watch Mojo video that I watched forever ago, that it did like top 10 actors who have never won an Oscar, and Peter O'Toole topped that list. I don't believe he ever won one.
No, I think he was nominated like 13 times or something, like Richard Burton. But I think they did give O'Toole a honorary Oscar.
An honorary.
Isn't winning an Oscar, but it was like, we're sorry, here.
Yeah, so the same thing with Alfred Hitchcock. But it's funny because that list is now, you know, out of times, I guess, because that list also had Leo and Gary Oldman on it.
And so, yes.
Not anymore.
No, and instead of sort of doing the Lifetime Achievement Award, they do it. Oh shit, we haven't given Leo Award. Quick, The Revenant. He made that. Right.
Exactly.
Maybe he should have won for about six other roles, but here you go. Same with Oldman with I can't remember that movie he won the Oscar for when he was playing Churchill.
I can't remember the name of the movie, but yeah. Playing Churchill.
Yes, he's memorable, the movie isn't, I think is probably again what you can take from that.
Yeah, it's so funny. I remember when The Revenant came out, it talked about all of the like physical torture that Leo put himself through, in like pretty much starving himself and like laying down like really in the snow. And people were like, for God's sake, give the man an Oscar before he kills himself.
Yes, and he hasn't done that since, which thank goodness, because he's like, right, I've got my Oscar. I don't need to go eat a raw liver on camera.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so much you should do for your role, and maybe, you know, lying in the snow and starving yourself isn't, you know, the thing you should do. I'm looking at you, Christian Bale.
That's right.
Who keeps doing it even though he has won Oscars.
And keeps fluctuating in weight to a point that's really concerning.
It is actually concerning. Every time I see him in a movie, I'm like, please just be, can you be yourself? I don't need you to lose all this weight. I don't need you to gain all this weight. I just want you to be healthy.
Yeah, we know you're talented, man.
Yes, we know you're talented. You don't need to keep doing that to yourself. My second trailer, I'm going... Oh, no, wait, your second trailer. Losing track. What is your second trailer for you were going to show for Harvey?
So my second trailer is for the other famous movie in which a guy's best friend is a potentially imaginary rabbit, Donnie Darko.
Donnie is experiencing what is commonly called a daylight hallucination.
I have to obey him. He saved my life.
Have you ever seen a portal?
Has he ever told you about his friend Frank, the giant bunny rabbit?
The what?
Every living thing follows along set path. And if you could see your path or channel, then you could see into the future, right?
Not going to be able to continue this conversation.
Of course. Sometimes you just have to have certain trailers in front of certain movies. And if you didn't have Donnie Darko in front of Harvey, it might be a bit weird. In fact, my partner came downstairs when I was watching Harvey and he goes, oh, what's this? Oh, I said, it's Harvey. It's about an imaginary rabbit. He goes, wait, isn't that Donnie Darko? I mean, no, this predates Frank.
Yes.
So he goes, oh, I didn't realize. So yeah, most people do know Donnie Darko and Frank the Rabbit, but they don't necessarily know about Harvey the Rabbit. But yeah, Donnie Darko is a movie I've come to like more and more. I don't think I loved it that much when it came out, even though don't think I even saw it at the theater. But I've gone back to it a few times, and the more I guess I can kind of appreciate what Richard Kelly was doing in that movie.
Mm-hmm. I think what a lot of people made the mistake, because as I recall now, Donnie Darko, what year did that come out?
2001, I think.
2001. Okay, so I was a youngster then, and here's the deal. And I think this was a lot of people's experience, because the movie wasn't a huge hit when it came out.
No.
And so when people sort of were walking around video stores and would see it, I think a lot of people assumed it was some creepy horror movie, because the cover of it is, yeah, Frank the Rabbit's face, and it looks really intimidating. Mm. So I think a lot of people went in with the wrong expectation.
Yes, and when they went in with the wrong expectation, they got this other weird movie and Patrick Swayze as a pedophile. So it's not a movie that, when I think back in 2001, you would watch it and you just go, what the hell is this? I think that is all through Donnie Darko, but then you go back to it and then you go, oh, Patrick Swayze's not playing... He's playing off type, which is interesting, and he's great in that movie, even if he's playing the worst person in the world. And
yeah, you love to hate.
The person you love to hate, and Jake Gyllenhaal's great. And it's a movie that I appreciate. I think as I get older, I appreciate Richard Kelly's weirdness more than I ever did when I was a late teen. Speaking of imaginary friends and going into dark situations, though this movie is very much on the lighter side, I'm going for Jojo Rabbit.
I don't think I can do this.
Russ? Of course you can.
When I was your age, I had an imaginary friend. Got me in so much trouble.
Kids, it's time to burn some books. Yeah!
He's a baby. Growing up too fast. 10-year-olds shouldn't be celebrating war and talking politics.
Hi, Hitler.
I wish more of our young boys had your blind fanaticism.
Did you know Jews can read each other's minds?
But how would you know if you saw one? They could look just like us.
Hi.
Did you ever see this movie?
I did not see it, but I am very familiar with the trailer.
Yes. That trailer played everywhere. If you ever thought that you would ever see Taika Waititi playing Hitler, you would have seen it at least in a trailer. This movie isn't perfect. I don't think it is my favorite Taika Waititi movie, even by far. But there is kind of this, I think there's a line he's trying to walk between kitsch and sweetness and pathos and darkness that I don't think he quite gets. But in saying that, I think he makes an hilarious Hitler. I think his German accent is just terrible enough to make it work. I love Jojo's best friend, who looks like a baby Nick Frost. And there's this little side character, this kid, every single time he turns up. He's kind of worse for wear, but he is even happier than he was when you saw him before. It's a really kind of cute running joke.
I've been meaning to get onto that.
Yeah, it's a very sweet movie. And when it does hit emotional... emotional points, it really does work. And plus, you've got a cast like Scarlett Johansson, Sam Rockwell. I didn't write all the cast down. The most funniest moment is probably the most inappropriate, with Steve Merchant playing something from the SS and a Hail Hitler joke that just goes on for way too far, but you were laughing by the end of it kind of thing. It's just one of those things where when it hits, but when it doesn't, it doesn't. And I think it is a messy movie, but I still think it is just a really fun movie of kind of not buying into the hype. Like, the one thing I love about it is that it's not really a spoiler, but it starts with a Beatles song, a really early I Want to Hold Your Hand, and it ends with David Bowie's Hero. And both kind of sort of represent this kind of people getting swept up in the fanness of, say, the Beatles, but then you've got this West Berlin, I think he wrote it in East Berlin, Bowie song. So he knows what he's doing within it, even if the whole thing doesn't quite come together.
Yeah. You know, it's a movie that I actually think it plays a bit of it for comedy, but it is about the Holocaust and really walks that tightrope beautifully.
Which one?
What's his name? Roberto Benigni's Life is Beautiful.
Yes. I still have not seen the beginning of this movie because I've only seen it once and it was on TV, but I was bawling my eyes out by the end of it. I didn't see the whole thing, but what I saw, I was just like, no.
Well, it's interesting you say you missed the beginning of it.
Mm.
Yeah, because so the movie actually starts off with Roberto Benigni sort of playing this waiter and he's sort of getting into like classic sort of Jerry Lewis style antics. And so it's a real juxtaposition when you get to the tragedy of the Holocaust and pretty much him trying to hide the terror of what's going on from his son by telling him that it's all a game. And he, you know, hey, if you, and just these heartbreaking moments of him telling him that it's just like, okay, the person who goes the longest without eating gets this many points for the day and just these really tragic things. But him using the power of humor to protect his son.
That I haven't seen it in ages, but I just do remember the time you get to those final shots because you're kind of relieved, even though everything's a tragedy, the ending is still really uplifting and you're like,
yes,
oh, it's going to be okay now. They've gotten through it. But no, that is a really, really good example of that. I think the Holocaust is really hard to make into a comedy. I think the only one I've ever seen that does it really successfully is The Producers.
Of course.
Even though that's not really about the Holocaust, but it is them making fun of Springtime for Hitler.
Of course.
Which I love that musical and I love that movie. Yeah, it is a really hard thing. And I think I can see what Taika Waititi is doing with Jojo Rabbit and just making fun of Hitler every step of the way. I mean, it is, that's amusing.
Exactly. I believe Mel Brooks said in an interview once that he wants to make $1 million by making fun of Hitler, and he's gone beyond that, I believe.
Oh, he really, really has. And because he always sort of says, if you laugh at him, you take away his power, which I think is true to some extent. Yes. And yeah, that is, I friggin' love The Producers. That is an amazing movie. Anyway, we're going to be getting into your favorite movie of all time. Harvey, starring Jimmy Stewart, directed by Henry Costa from 1950.
Well, Harvey and I sit in the bars and have a drink or two, play the jukebox. And soon the faces of all the other people, they turn toward mine and they smile. And they're saying, we don't know your name, mister, but you're a very nice fellow. Harvey and I warm ourselves in all these golden moments. We've entered as strangers. Soon we have friends. And they come over and they sit with us. They drink with us. They talk to us. They tell about the big, terrible things they've done and the big, wonderful things they'll do.
Now, you've really spoke really, you've already spoken very eloquently on Harvey, on the Film Feast show with Matt. Just for, I guess, again, what is it about this movie that you love?
So it's actually funny. On that same one, I mentioned my second favorite movie of all time is Rocky. Mm. And I realized what it comes down to is both those movies do the same thing for me. Mm. And it's really just sort of how the movie hits you. Both those movies make me want to be more than I am. Like, those movies hit me in a way where I'm just like, you know, I wish I could be more like this person. Like, of course, in Rocky, it's going the distance. It's, yes, you know, trying your best. And you know what? Whether you succeed or not, you did everything you could. And Harvey hits me in a way that makes me want to be more than I am, in just that I want to be as optimistic and as kind and as trusting as Elwood P. Dowd is. I mean, just the scene where, I mean, it's towards the end, but when Dr. Chumley is telling him, your sister was trying to have you committed here. She organized this whole thing. He's like, well, Vita Louise did all that in an afternoon. She sure is a whirlwind, isn't she?
Just
the optimism.
Yeah, no, nothing can get Elwood D. Oh, I've forgotten his name now. I wrote it down. Elwood D. Dunn or Elwood D. Dowd down. He is, yes, this kind of, and it's a phenomenal performance by James Stewart. If you, he's kind of like a sly comedian. Like, you never quite think he's going to be funny, and all of a sudden he does this amazing physical performance. Like, just the way he moves and the way he kind of lets room in for Harvey, which I don't. He's a giant rabbit. Who's, yes, who's Elwood's friend. And they, yes, basically
6 foot 3.5 inches. It's 6 foot 3.5 inches. Let's stick to the facts.
Yes, definitely. And he causes all kinds of trouble for everyone around him who don't know necessarily how to accommodate Harvey, but Harvey already knows how to accommodate him. Mm-hmm. And it's just this gorgeous movie of people learning to accept others. Like, I think one of the first notes I wrote down is that this is a almost, not quite, but getting there, almost progressive look at how to treat either mental illness or something like that, because it's not about locking them away. It's just about going, oh, this is who you are, and we need to accommodate, yeah, everyone of all shapes and sizes. It's not just you need to be good, you need to be polite, you need to be this or that. It's, no, everyone's accepted. And even though you may be hard to deal with at times, which I can imagine looking into Josephine Hull's sister character, could be very difficult living with a man like Elwood and Harvey. She still, by the end, accepts them for who they are. It's like, no, I want my brother to be my brother. And it's a really interesting, yes, look at, if you want to have a look at, say, if Elwood is, in fact, mentally ill or something, there is something else going on. It's not about, I need to fix him or I need to put him away where he can't be a pain. It's, no, I just want him to be my brother. And that's actually a really sweet, yes, movie for 1950.
It's a really beautiful moment too, because, and here's what's, here's something that I sort of think of when you sort of get to that famous scene where the cab driver comes up and she tells him, look, he's just getting this shot right now. And the cab driver's like, well, I want my tip now, or I want my payment now, because when he comes out of there, he's not going to want to pay me. He's not going to tip me. He's going to be a jerk. And they're just like, what are you talking about? Elwood's always been like this. And he says, not after this, he won't be. After this, he'll be a perfectly normal human being. And you know what stinkers they are. And sorry, I'm sort of going long-winded here.
No, please.
But then Josephine Hull has this look on her face, and she's just like, no, I don't want him to be like that. I don't like people like that. And to me, that goes back to that earlier scene where their family friend, who they call Aunt, I forget her name.
Is that the one in the beginning who...
the older woman who, when she's looking in the party, she's just like, oh, doesn't she look drab? Doesn't she just look dreadful? What's she doing with her life?
Yes.
And that's where Viola is going, like, I don't like people like that. I love him the way he is.
Mm. No, it is. It's such a sweet moment about just accepting people for who they are, no matter who they, what their thing is. In 1930s, I keep going back to the mental illness thing because...
And you're right, people, I've heard that discussed before, that it's a really forward thinking way to depict, you know, mental differences or handicaps.
Exactly. Though what really interested me in this movie was not necessarily also the mental illness, but Elwood's drinking, especially the way Jimmy Stewart plays him, because when you first meet him, I don't think he's in the bar, but then he goes to the bar, hangs out, he knows everyone. Everyone knows his name. It's all great. And then he goes back to the house where his sister's trying to throw a party. And he comes in and he doesn't really ruin it, but he just makes things a bit more complicated. And then I was just like going, wait, is he... And then, because it's me, I start reading into it way too much. But it's kind of this fascinating thing. Is it because he's seeing Harvey... Because the movie plays it five different ways. Either Harvey's a real creature, mm-hmm. or you... only see him when you're drunk, or him and Elwood have this kind of bond where only he can see him, but then sometimes other people can see him. Like even Hull has that moment of says, oh, sometimes I think I see a 6'3" rabbit. And it's kind of when you're in a sort of a state of mind, and I just always, it always changes which state of mind that is, which I find really, it's in the writing and it's so clever because this is based on a play. And the more I started watching it and started watching more of Jimmy Stewart's body language, I'm like, wait, is he? No, he's just really happy. No, wait, is he drunk? Wait, I don't know. Because the movie can never say explicitly that, but it's kind of woven into the DNA of the movie. And it's so great.
Yeah. And when Matt and I were talking about this, now he had only seen it once. I loaned him my DVD of it.
Yeah.
And you know, it didn't hit him the same way it hit me, which you know, is fine. Every movie's going to hit people differently. But he made the point, he was asking sort of like, you know, and this was like years ago before we recorded that podcast, when he asked me, and he was asking me, so like, what is it about this you love so much? Because, and he points out, and admittedly, the movie doesn't have like a ton of like inventive camera tricks or making, but you were just talking about the great, you know, just all the subtleties in writing. And it does leave you asking those questions.
It really does. And it's all because of the script and the performances, and especially James Stewart. There's a way that he's always kind of smiling, the way he's kind of leaning, the way he sort of opens his arms when he's trying to introduce Harvey or pulls up a chair. And it kind of builds into this fast nature, because everyone's like, why are you pulling up a spare chair? Who's sitting there? And he's like, well, Harvey's sitting there. And but the thing that you spoke of at the ending when... Josephine Hull realizes that she doesn't want her brother to get the shot that will magically either make him sober or stop seeing Harvey. And she goes, no, I want my brother to be himself. I don't want him to be a normal person. The one that really got me is when James Stewart's sitting in the bar because they've lost Dr. Chumley. They think he's something to do with it. And also Harvey isn't there either, because essentially Harvey's gone off with Dr. Chumley. And he's sitting down and he's in the alleyway and he's telling the story of how he met Harvey for the first time. And that's the one that kind of broke me, because it's this amazingly sad story about this man who knows he doesn't quite fit in. He's being kind to everyone, but people don't necessarily understand him. And then he meets Harvey and the two click instantly. And that is, it's about finding your soulmate, essentially. And,
and
it's so beautiful.
And there's something so charming just about him describing that moment of, you know, and I asked him what his name is, and he said, well, what name do you like? And I said, well, I didn't have to think. Harvey had always been my favorite name. So I said, Harvey. And he says, well, what a coincidence. My name happens to be Harvey.
Yes. It is such a great moment, because you realize this man who may be lonely, who may have a drinking problem, may not. The movie never goes into it. So it all depends on how you read into it. Like when I sort of said, oh, I'm watching it on Twitter, there were two very separate distinctions. People thought he was an alcoholic, people who thought he wasn't. And it's quite interesting to how people read into that. But it was just this beautiful moment of, oh no, I found my person. Oh, I found my rabbit in this case. I can't get over how great this James Stewart performance is in this, because he's a great actor. You just watch any James Stewart movie, you know he's just absolutely brilliant. But to watch this and kind of get the pathos, the sadness, the slight, the wobbliness of someone who may have had one or too many drinks, but the general joy of it. He's like in this haze in his own world, and you're like, no, I kind of want to be where he is.
Exactly. I want to, you know, be optimistic about everyone I meet. When I go to a bar and I see this guy, and if he tells me he's got a criminal record, I don't want to judge him for that. I want to assume the best in him.
Exactly. And I love how everyone else, especially the other doctor and nurse, oh, the nurse wants to like Harvey, but she's kind of trying to do what the doctor's doing, but how that second doctor instantly thinks that Harvey and the porter of the sanitarium are instantly going, okay, you've done something with Dr. Chumley. What have you done? This must be bad. You're crazy. Something must be really nefarious here. And it's not, because he's such a genuine person that he's just like, no, we went and had a drink. He met Harvey. Now they've gone off and had their own adventure.
Yeah. And so you mentioned your favorite sort of dialogue in the movie being that scene where he's describing when he first met Harvey. For me, my favorite line of dialogue in the whole movie is, that moment when he first tells Dr. Chumley, oh, Vita did that in all in an afternoon. She sure is a whirlwind. And then he says, good heavens, man, don't you have any sense of righteous indignation? And he tells him this story. You know, my mother used to tell me, in this world, you must be oh so smart or oh so pleasant. And, you know, for years I was smart. I recommend pleasant.
Yes, you do get hints of this other life he might have had, which I love. It's only in a couple of, it's like that kind of line there. I can't remember another specific one, but you get the sense that this is not a thing. Al was never grown up like this. And this is why I love the script so much. I mean, yes, this movie isn't De Palma, where you're getting a camera movement every 5 minutes, but it just settles in because they, Harry Costa, even if he was just a run-of-the-mill director, knew that you just pointed the camera on everyone and just let them do their thing, hit their marks and do that. But I love the idea of, he's done all this. He's been the regular guy and he doesn't want to do that anymore. He just wants to be himself. Now, the fact that he gets to live with his sister, obviously, makes his life easier. But if he was living on the street, I don't think it'd be any different. It's just that's his circumstances.
Well, I believe they do mention in the movie that technically he's not living with them. They're living with him because, you know, her inheritance to him. So he's sort of independently wealthy.
Oh, yes. I forgot about that part. Yes, that is a very good point. He is independently wealthy. So he doesn't have to think that. But maybe once he is independently wealthy, he's just like, I can do whatever I want. And I can be nice, which is more when people go, I can do whatever I want, turns into Westworld. This is just like, I just want to get to know, I want to talk to people. And I love the fact that he goes to a bar, because what better place you can go and talk to people is at a bar.
Yeah, absolutely. So something that's interesting to me is, you know, Jimmy Stewart was nominated for Best Lead Actor for this. He didn't win. Josephine Hull for Vita Louise was nominated. Well, she won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress. But here's something I want to ask you. So I think the rule everyone recognizes in storytelling is, you know, who's the main character? The main character is the one who goes through a change.
Yes.
You know, Michael Corleone at the beginning of the movie, he says, that's my family, Kay, that's not me. And then by the end, he has become the godfather. The character who really goes through the most change in this movie is Vita Louise.
It really is. It's kind of like, I would agree with that. She won Best Supporting, but she is kind of the one that has the arc. Elwood is Elwood. He's kind of like Mary Poppins in a way. The movie's named after Mary Poppins, but she doesn't go through the change. It's the Banks' father that goes through the change, and he's a supporting character. So it's kind of one of those tricks in storytelling where your main focus is this kind of magical entity, but it's how they affect everyone else around them, including his sister.
Yeah, and really everyone sort of is uplifted and changed through their interactions with Elwood and with Harvey. Especially, you know, it's funny, the very ending, which is just another sweet moment I love, where, you know, the gates of the mental hospital open up, and he says, I thought you decided to stay with Dr. Chumley. Oh, well, thank you, Harvey. I prefer you too. There's part of me that thinks, you know what? I bet Dr. Chumley still does have his very own to call them what they are, Puka.
I love that notion.
Well, and there's even, yeah, exactly. I would definitely say that he sort of got his own Harvey. And Elwood even tells Dr. Chumley all these stories about how Harvey, you know, he's surpassed time and space and he can do anything.
I love that moment when he tells that mate, again, this is just, most of my favorite parts is when James Stewart is telling a story. But he tells us, yes. He has it, and they're not big, long, big monologues. It's just him speaking very quietly. And it's sort of just how he says that Harvey can stop time and then you can go wherever you want and then come back at that exact moment. I think it's like the most brilliant, concise thing of imagination I've ever heard in a movie. And it's beautiful.
And I really think, man, for 1950, that's just so ahead of its time in thinking. So big shout out to the original playwright, Mary Chase.
Mm. Now, you've actually seen this play, haven't you?
Yes, we actually went and saw it in Smithfield, Virginia. And you know what was so neat about it was before the show started, the actor who played Elwood, he just sort of stepped down and was talking to the audience. And he's just like, here, let me give you my card. Now, if you want to call me at this number, not that one. That's the old one. So he was going to the audience and being Elwood.
Oh, my God. That is the best running joke in the movie is the gone dab, him trying to give the card. When he does it in the taxi, it's like, yes, as you said, here's my card. Call me at that number, but not that one. And then through all the movie, every single time he wants to introduce himself or tell him a bit more information, he'll go, here's my card. And then he can never give it to anyone else.
Yeah. And whenever he tries to introduce them to Harvey, he's typically interrupted.
Yes. Oh my God. The whole thing, because what I love about this movie is that his sister's had enough. He's taking him to a sanitarium. The porter's really rough with him. There's a way he pulls him into the elevator that's just like a whoop kind of thing. Yeah. Quick. It's like, Jesus Christ. There's this very gentle, slow-paced man, and then you're rushing him. And there's this kind of thing that the sister has when she's talking to one of the other doctors, saying she's upset. She doesn't know how to deal with her brother. She doesn't know how to communicate with him. Even though she is technically living in his house, which now has just brought up a whole bunch of other kind of, what does this actually mean? Kind of things that maybe untoward to poor Elwood. But it's just like, I sometimes get to the state where I see the white rabbit, because he's 6 foot, 3 inches, 2 inches, whatever it is. And let's stick to the facts. And it's, and so the doctor has her committed, because he's going, well, you're seeing, the rabbit, because you're trying to pretend to, that's what he's thinking, it's because she lives with him, she's trying to take over the estate, so I'm gonna pretend that he's crazy and so I can live in the house. That's not exactly what's happening. So everyone, and then of course Harvey just sort of goes off as talking to them, and he's constantly trying to, here's my friend Harvey, and pulling up the chair. They don't know who's sitting in the chair, and it's this amazing comedy farce of just, and it's so sweet, and the timing is just so good on it, purely just because, again, of James Stewart.
Yeah, and I do love that moment. You had alluded to it before, but when he's sitting with the nurse and the doctor, and he's just making little innuendos about Harvey, and he sort of nudges him and winks.
Yes!
Visual acting there.
Oh, it is so good. Just his timing and the way he moves his body is amazing. Like, when they're sitting at the booth, and it's like, no, Harvey's right over at the other side of the booth. Chumley could see him. And it's it's this kind of gorgeous, gorgeous just moment. I just cannot get over James Stewart's. I mean, I thought I had favorite performances all laid out. This is now one of my favorite James Stewart performances. I think he makes...
I'm so glad to hear it.
Like I would have said, oh, of course it's Rear Window. It's the Christmas movie, I can't believe I'm blanking. It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
I would have said those ones, which I still think are amazing and top tier Jimmy Stewart, like the Philadelphia Story. But then you see this, and then you're seeing everything put together, because you do not usually see him as this physical actor, because he's Jimmy Stewart. And this one, you're kind of seeing what he can do, and he's kind of doing both roles of him and Harvey in a weird way.
In a way, yeah.
Yeah, it's an amazing kind of thing. I was actually trying to look up who bet James Stewart in the 1951 Oscars. And it keeps telling me that it was Harvey Bogart, but I didn't think he won until 1952. So that's what I've been doing. But he should have won. I mean, it's an amazing performance. I think Josephine Hull deservedly won for her performance, because I think she is such this great counterpoint, and no one does upset and kind of fidgety like her. Just because you can see her looking at him going, I don't know how to contain you. I don't know how to behave.
In that moment where it's revealed that Harvey or that Elwood replaced the portrait of his mother with a painting of him and Harvey together.
That's
such a gorgeous moment.
When she sees it, she's just like almost gonna faint. She's like, "Oh my god!" When he walks,
and before she and before she gets to look at the painting, she's just like, "Dr. Chum, like, I know about art. A photograph just shows you the reality. A portrait shows you beyond that."
And then there it is. I love when he actually walks in with it, because he's sort of holding this big thing and he is sort of talking about it. And I love the idea of, and again, that whole idea of this kind of weird space-time continuum universe that they only do in words. This is a thing where Elwood and Harvey go off and have adventures. He can go get his portrait painted and Harvey's absolutely sitting there. They can see him because a portrait will show you beyond reality. And it's this kind of cool thing of when they find the hat with the rabbit ears sticking the little holes. And they're just, it's this great moment where they're playing with it. And was the stage play a really cathartic experience? Because you could see all those little moments played out in front of you. Or did it not quite begin the magic of the movie? If that question makes sense.
No, it was, it pretty much is beat for beat the story. There are a few minor changes. But I will say this, the play leans more into the comedy than the sentimentality. It's still there in it, you know, the comedy and the sentimentality are in both, obviously. But like, I'm trying to think of like a good specific example of, something that's played for sentiment in the movie is played for comedy in the show, but I'm blanking on a specific moment. But it was neat seeing, you know, different actors' portrayal of all these characters. Honestly, in the stage show, the actress who really blew me away was the one playing the daughter Myrtle May.
Oh, yeah. She kind of gets a little bit sidelined in the movie, so it would have been interesting to sort of see who stood out more in the stage play.
Yeah, it was her, and of course the actor playing Elwood, he was fantastic. And at the end of the show, you got to, go up and meet the cast. And, you know, what was really neat was when they're all doing their bow, they're all wearing rabbit ears, and they're all about to do a bow. And then the actor who played Dr. Sanderson sort of nudges the guy, just like, hey, scooch to the side, and they leave a space in between two of the actors to do a bow. Yep.
Oh, that is adorable. That is how it should be. You always have to leave a space for Harvey.
Of course.
Oh, this movie's... Oh, and I finally found out, sorry, who actually won Best Actor for 1951. Jose Ferreira for Sienna de Bernanac, which I have never seen. But he was up against William Holden, Sunset Boulevard. That's actually an amazing performance. Louis Calhoun, The Magnificent Yankee, still never seen. Spencer Tracy, Father of the Bride, speaking of actors who I think got nominated every second year. And of course, James Stewart for Harvey. My picks would have been definitely William Holden or James Stewart, possibly James Stewart just nudging out the thing. But yeah, I just realizing how amazing 1951 Oscars would have been, especially with all about
EV. That's a ton of talent.
That's a ton of talent. That's a ton of... 1950 was an amazing year for movies. That's one of those years you go, holy crap, that was released. And that Harvey's one of them is... And the fact that when you watch movies from that year, you're just like going, holy crap, something was in the water in 1949, because they are just making magic.
Yeah, there was just... I mean, they were on fire. They were batting 900 that year.
Oh, they really, really were. It's... Yeah, with the Sidewalk-ins, Jesus Christ, Rashomon, wow. The Asphalt Jungle, and The Lonely Place. Okay, yeah, 1950 might be one of the great movie years, and I've never heard it talked about, and I think it should be. And Harvey is one of those examples about why 1950 should be talked about more.
Absolutely. I'm so pleased that you were so touched by the movie. I'm really glad it really resonated with you.
No, it really surprised me because as I said, I didn't realize it was your favorite movie. I hadn't gone back and listened to the episode yet when I watched it, because you did your five favorites on Film Feast. And just from those moments when you start seeing Jimmy Stewart work, And that first time where he introduces Harvey on the bar, I was just, because all I knew was of this movie was that it was about a rabbit. And meet my friend Harvey, and to actually see what this movie is able to do just with dialogue, because it is a play, and the places it manages to go outside its like three locations is a magical, magical thing. So thank you for giving me the excuse to finally watch this. It was amazing.
Well, I mean, it's my pleasure, Lindsay, and like I said, and you know what, everyone listening to this, I hope you, you know, give this one a chance, because I think it's one of the greats.
Yeah, I really do as well. It's just it's a happy movie. I think there is a really amazing undercurrent of sadness, which I think is purely what Stuart is doing. I don't think it's in the script at all. I think he's meant to be this uplifting guy, but because it's James Stewart, he's giving you this undercurrent of sadness with it. This kind of knowledge that, oh, I live in this amazing world, but no one else does. And no one else seems to get it. And I may be lonely because of it, but now I have Harvey, so this makes everything okay. And the way the movie kind of plays, dances around that notion is chef's kiss. Yeah, it's such a good script. I mean, yeah, watch it and just study that script and you'll realize how good that script is.
Yeah, absolutely.
And with that, we might as well go on to something that I wouldn't exactly call uplifting, but...
No, not exactly.
But outrageous, yes, and delightfully so. Now, the second study features gather is about to start. Like our last one, we've gone from the classic and now we're going into the midnight, as we did with the Phantom of the Opera's movie. Another 80s gore fest. What would your first trailer be for Basket Case?
The first one I'm pairing with this is a movie called Shockma.
It started as a study of human aggression. It led to experiments on primates. But something went wrong. Starring Christopher Atkins, two-time recipient of the National Association of Theater Owners Star of the Year Award. First for Blue Lagoon, now for Shockma.
Which I actually, Matt Bledsoe, when I was hanging out at his apartment a few years ago, he showed me this trailer. And I just love it because the very ending is what makes it, is he's listing off all these actors. What's funny is he lists one actor and he mentions some like really obscure award this guy won. I'm like, I've never heard of that award. But then what's great is it's just like this person, that person. And it's like, and Shockma! And like the monkey just stands up. And then the guy, the narrator just yells, Shockma!
It is a name that you need to yell. If you just don't, if you cannot just go Shockma, you go Shockma! Because that is an angry bamboo. And I haven't seen the trailer for a while. This is one I didn't rewatch, but I kind of love this movie. I'm a little worried for the baboon because he just seems too angry. I don't quite know what they were doing to make that.
To agitate him
like that, because he is, every time you see him, he is slamming himself into doors. But the whole idea of being stuck in this building that you cannot get out of, and you're there with a rabid baboon, is such a great concept. And he's terrifying. I mean, he's a full-grown massive male baboon. He's agitated. He's slamming himself into doors. And I know that they obviously didn't, there are a lot of times they didn't film, because I had a couple of baboons, I think. They didn't film the actors with the baboon, but they look like they sometimes got way too close. And I'm like, that thing can move.
Oh, yeah. And those things are like dangerous, man. Like baboons and chimpanzees, they've got like strength to them.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, you can see walls shaking. It's insane.
Yeah. Now I will say my personal favorite killer monkey movie is Monkey Shines. Have you seen that one?
Wait, Monkey Shines, is that the Romero one?
Yeah, Romero with the monkey who's like injected with brain juice.
I have seen this movie. I was getting it confused with another monkey movie, but yes, no, I love Monkey Shines.
What's crazy is that movie is like 2 hours long. It is longer than a killer monkey movie should be.
It absolutely should, but you don't feel it. Like, you really feel that connection. Is the monkey called Amy or Allie?
I believe it is.
Yeah.
One of the two.
One of the two. You feel that connection between the monkey and the lead in Monkey Shines, because you realize it's one of those movies when Okay, I like The Bone Collector, but I realize it's false. But usually having a movie that is meant to be about movement and your main actor is meant to be paralyzed from the neck down doesn't always kind of create a interesting movie. Purely because my theory is movies need movement. But that's just me. But that you do absolutely buy the connection between those two, and that is absolutely fascinating. And you want them to be together, but at the same time, I would just call her Amy, just take things way too far. And you're just like, oh, no, Amy, can we calm? Oh, no. And then you're just like, yes, get that monkey in your mouth and shake it with all your force that
That is a bananas scene where he like, and it's like heartbreaking because like first she's like nuzzling up against his chest and then he like, bites on her head and just flings her back and forth. I'm like, Jesus Christ.
It feels like overkill, but at the same time, you kind of know what this monkey is kind of capable of and she's just a little too obsessed. Amy is a definite character, probably more than Shakma is, because Shakma is something you want to get away from. Amy's something that you actually want in your life until you realize that she's going to kill everyone around you.
Yeah.
Completely isolate the situation. She's like an abusive partner, but it's a monkey.
Oh, yeah, well put.
No, Shakma is a great, great trailer. It is absolutely perfect because it is just this massive menace that is terrifying, much like Belial, as we will get into.
Yes.
My first trailer, I changed my mind about several times what I was going to do, but my, can't remember what I told you at the beginning, but my first one is going to be, Reanimator by Stuart Gordon from 1985.
Herbert West is at the top of his class in medical school.
How can you teach such drivel? These people are here to learn and you're closing their minds before they even have a chance.
He's brilliant, but a little weird.
I've broken the 6 to 12 minute barrier. I've conquered brain death.
His experiments have always been unorthodox.
It was dead.
But lately, they're getting out of hand. And he's just made a discovery that could wake up the dead.
Ah, yes.
There was a certain moment that happens in Basket Case that is similar and slightly even more deranged that happens in Reanimator. And if you know that moment, you know exactly what I'm talking about. It's not as explicit as Reanimator, but it does happen. And when I realized that the first time I was watching it, I was like going, oh dear God, no. Reanimator is one of the
scene.
The scene.
well, I was going to say, we'll talk about that when we actually talk about the movie. Yeah. Go ahead.
Reanimator is just one of those most inventive horror movies I have seen in a while. It is demented. It takes its point and takes it to its most illogical conclusion, especially with that end scene, the head. It is just, I love this movie. Every time I watch it, I just start giggling manically every time I see it. I think it's just a wonderful, strange, brutal movie.
Yeah, Jeffrey Combs just has like this voice too that is just, I don't know how to describe it, but it just gets under your skin.
It does. Go join a sideshow. It's just, he's awful, but you don't hate him, which I think is a really fine line, especially with that voice. It's getting under your skin. He's kind of the villain and the hero of the piece, which I don't quite know how he pulled off.
Yeah. I mean, it's, like you said, he's awful, but you don't hate him. I mean, as cliched and as praised as this performance is, I mean, that's sort of the same thing with Heath Ledger's Joker. You know, deranged and awful, but he's an interesting character and I want to follow him.
You cannot take your eyes off him. And I would have been interesting to see where he would have taken that character if he'd been able to, because he is just so fascinating in that role. You really cannot take your eyes off him. And just there's a way he moves around. That is a brilliant comparison. What is your second trailer for Basket Case?
So the reason I chose Shakma as my first trailer was pretty much, you know, the connection I made was, you know, yeah, like 80s, 90s, you know, cheesy monster movie. And that sort of goes the same with my second one, but the second one again has to do with, you know, sort of a pal that a character has, and it's a man's best friend.
Exactly what kind of work do you do here?
I do genetic research.
I want to do the intro to the story. Is this dog an innocent victim? And this doggy, Max!
I want Max back. We're not talking about a street mutt here. We are talking about a $1 million research animal.
Thank you, Max. Sweet.
See, Max is not your typical dog. He's a genetic crossbreed.
Get him, Max! Sick him!
Enhanced sight, hearing, strength, stamina. The ability to climb with jaguar-like agility.
Yes, I still have not seen this. I saw the trailer and now I kind of really should get on to seeing this. This looks deranged.
You know, a lot of people might sort of see that trailer or just hear about it and think, yeah, oh, it's just a knockoff of Cujo.
Yeah.
But this, much like Shockma, it's an animal who's being experimented on, and this dog develops like predator cloaking powers. and it like pees acid. It's bananas.
Oh, it really did. And you know, if it's got Lance Hendrickson, I'm in. But it's,
yes,
I don't know, it's kind of a hard trailer to describe because you're right. It sort of starts off, and I think they are definitely marketing it as, hey, you remember Cujo? Cujo was a freak of nature. He got rabies and was a large Saint Bernard. This is an experiment that's sort of gone very wrong. It's kind of like,
yes,
the movie Alligator, where they're feeding all this, yeah, alligator, these like experimented on dogs, and he becomes this super alligator. And you have to get Henry Silver to go hunt him. And yeah, it's kind of got that kind of cool vibe about it. And it's early 90s, so it looks... Is it early 90s? Yes, it is. So it kind of looks like...
Yeah, 93, I think.
Yeah, 93. It's got that early 90s feel of... I actually begin to love early 90s horror. It feels like they haven't quite... They're just throwing everything at the wall to see what sticks because they haven't got that thing that...
sort of defining the era.
Defining the era like they would in Scream. So they haven't defined the era yet, so they're just throwing everything at it. And... in that you get man's best friend, like you,
yes,
get Wishmaster or all those kind of amazing early 90s movies where you're just watching it going, or Dr. Giggles, and you're just like going, yep, this is definitely early 90s.
Exactly. That, you know, Candyman.
Exactly, Candyman. Oh, God, I love Candyman.
Yes, very excited to see the remake sequel coming out.
A remake sequel, yes. I don't know which quite one it is, but... I haven't watched any trailers except the first one. So I've heard rumors that Tony Todd might be coming back. I just don't know.
Ooh, how. Excellent. I told Matt this. I never thought the song Say My Name could be foreboding.
Yet it is. It really is. They use that. Usually the whole slow down of a song, I'm just like, okay, really? We've done this. But when they use Say My Name, I'm just like, oh, that is a bit too perfect. Now I'm scared.
Yep.
Okay, so my second trailer, I'm going for one of the other great budget creature feature directors. But this one is more LA. Starting from 1974, I'm going for It Lives, Larry Cohen.
Ah.
It's alive. It's alive.
Can you hear me? It can't be saved. It's gotta die.
It's alive. It's alive.
Why are you so anxious to be the one to do it?
It's alive. It's alive!
Now, nobody knows how this thing happened. It's really a matter of speculation, and I think perhaps that's for the best. After all, if we find out that the cause is medication that we manufacture, and it was administered over a long period of time, won't it?
Excellent.
Yes, I love this movie. I still actually haven't seen the sequel, which is on me, but I love... It's Alive, The Island of the Alives with Michael Moriarty just going full Moriarty. But this one has another great character actor who I'm blanking on, but it is this amazing Frankenstein story, kind of similar to Basket Case. Well, they are being women to be given these fertility drugs, but it makes their babies monstrous. And so now this couple has given birth to a monster, and John P. Ryan, I think, is the guy. He pops up in like Bound and a Runaway Train. He's a guy who's popping up a lot that I'm absolutely loving. He's kind of dealing with the fact that he's the father of a monster, and it's got these really great Frankenstein themes. I don't know. I love this movie. It's a great creature feature. And I kind of love low budget. I'm just going to make a movie. We're going to make a monster. Let's see how it goes kind of thing. And It's Alive has definitely got more money than Basket Case, but it's got the same in spirit.
Exactly. You know, it's sort of like, I would sort of describe It Lives as like, hey, you know what? If Rosemary's Baby wasn't about the pregnancy, but about the baby itself, here's what it might be.
Yes, that would be an amazing double feature, actually. Rosemary's Baby followed by It Lives.
Heard it here, folks.
You heard it here. That would be, yeah, you're right. It is literally, and even Jumpy Ryan gives this amazing speech about how much he loves his son and he knows he's the one who has to kill him. This is a baby. I mean, these are little monster baby running around doing his thing. And when I say it has more money, that movie was not made for not much as well. And then we'll get into Basket Case about how that was literally made with some masking tape.
With chump change, yeah.
Chump change that you found on the back of the couch, which is one of the reasons why I love it. Frank Henenlotter and Larry Cohen are two great genre filmmakers who I just love because they embody the spirit of make what creature features or genre movies are meant to be. And they can put so much into it with so little and make these amazing things. And of course, It's Alive is an amazing example of that.
Yeah, I think Kevin Smith was quoted saying that, you know, when you've got a smaller budget, it almost forces you to be more creative.
Exactly, yes. I think he said that a few times because you have to work with what you have. You can't bring everything in and make this kind of huge thing. You have to go, right, I have these three things. How do I mix and match them to make it interesting?
Yes.
And as we are about to get into, this is Basket Case in a nutshell.
I was just going to say, before we do talk about Basket Case, I do have to ask you a question, Lindsay.
Yeah, of course.
Do you have the time to listen to me whine about nothing and everything all at once?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Had to make the Green Day reference there.
Yes, I do. I always have time for Green Day. or am I just stoned? That is the question.
Exactly. I mean, from watching this movie, you might feel that way.
Yes, I've never seen this movie stoned, but it is one of those movies where you kind of go, this is kind of a close approximation, except I'm not fully asleep.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, what am I watching? My God, the woman reading to Belial is one of my favorite images of all time. Just the look on his face. And with that, we're going to be getting into Frank Henenlotter's classic 1982's Basket Case.
What is the secret Dwayne is hiding in the basket?
What's in the basket? Easter eggs?
What's in the basket?
Clothes.
What's in the basket?
Nothing.
What's in the basket?
My brother.
How did you come across this strange little movie?
So when I first heard of it, and you may have heard me mention this guy on Film Feast, I'm a pretty big fan of James Rolfe of Cinemassacre. Mm-hmm. And every year on Halloween, he does his Monster Madness. And like way back in 2009, he mentioned Basket Case. And that's where I first heard of it.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and then back when, I'm not sure if you remember, like back, 2010, 2011, Netflix had everything on it at that point. I'm not sure if it was the same in Australia.
No, I don't think we even had it at that point. But I was very jealous. I knew that it had everything. Like,
yeah,
I was aware.
Back then.
Yeah.
Like I would look up any like Dario Argento movie on Netflix and it would be up there. Now, of course, everything is like taken off of Netflix. And that's how I watched it for the first time.
Oh my God. Yeah. I saw this movie relatively recently. I think I first heard about it when, like most movies like this back in the early 2010s, it was through F This Movie when they would go to their 24-hour movie massacre marathon, or Patrick would make him and JB do it. And they were talking about Basket Case, and just the way they described it, I was like, what the hell is this movie? Because there's only a few ways you can describe this movie, because purely of what Belial is, it's like this lump of like clay that you use to plug up your gaps in your bathroom is that's kind of what it looks like, this potato thing. And I was just like, what is it? And then I couldn't quite get my hands on it for a little while, because as any Australian or New Zealander knows, back in the day in the noughties, we heard about this thing called streaming, but we couldn't get streaming, which is probably why Australia and New Zealand had the highest piracy rates of any country.
Sailing the seven seas.
Yes. Unfortunately, it was, dark time, just because it was kind of that break between we were hearing about everything because we had Twitter and Facebook and social media, but we didn't necessarily have access. Because they hadn't opened up the copyright. Now they've kind of, we've got streaming services. They've opened up copyright laws in Australia because now they know they just have to let us be able to buy stuff or stream stuff. Now it's a lot better. Mm-hmm. I can get, like, I have Imprint now and I have Indicator and have all these amazing things I can get my hands on. So it wasn't until, I think, I can't even remember. I think it was YouTube the first time I saw it. I typed it in, saw the full movie. I went, yes, I finally get to see it.
Was it chopped into, chopped into like part one of 10?
Yeah, something like that. It was a really terrible way to watch it. Like, it wasn't great. And my computer at the time was complete crap. And now I have the Blu-ray. And of course, it's on Tubi. And there are multiple places I can get this thing. Just have to get the sequels now. And it blew my mind because I didn't think someone would be crazy enough to make a movie like this. Now I know Frank Henelot is an intelligent man who might be have his own Harvey on the side, his own Belial. But when I first watched, I was like, how was this allowed up on YouTube? And two, how did this get made? And it was kind of my introduction into this kind of movie making, that you can actually, no matter how little money you have, you can put what you have in your head on screen and make it work.
Yeah, because I believe this had, like, what, $35,000?
Yeah. I mean, no professional actors, except for maybe Beverly Bonner, I think her name is. But yeah, it's literally, I think they actually went to a flop house in New York City in 1980 and made it.
I'm pretty sure it was all like,
yeah,
I think it was all like sort of guerrilla filmmaking, like when they were filming in the streets of New York City. Like, I think like one of the shop owners was like angry and he was like thinking that they were like a news team trying to like film his store. But when he found out they were making a movie, he was totally fine with it then.
Yes, because it captures. I love movies because I've talked to Matt about this. I love movies filmed in New York in the early 80s. It looks like an atrocious place to live where you'll be mugged on a daily basis.
Oh, this movie looks so dirty and grimy.
Oh, you could just get syphilis just by walking into a room. This is the kind of movie it looks like. Yeah. But it looks like this amazing time of this kind of poverty, this crunch poverty, because New York was pretty much bankrupt at this stage. But this amazing creativity, and everyone's creative. Like, even if it is something sleazy, if you watch New York Ripper, it's just 24 hours of sex shows, which maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, I don't know. But there's this kind of buzz around it, and everyone's kind of making something, whether it's trying to sell you something that isn't real or making a movie or something. It's, I really love this movie. Purely because I look at it and like, oh, you're in New York. You're walking down the streets. I can see the marquee of the Kung Fu triple feature, which I would have loved to have gone to. It's just those movie theaters, those grindhouses. Everyone is from a different nation. Like, really what New York was kind of that proper New York melting pot of everyone being from somewhere else. Everyone just trying to get through the day, whether they're breaking the law, dealing drugs, making a movie for $30,000, $35,000. It's just got this energy that I don't think you see anywhere else, and especially anywhere else in filmmaking.
Yeah, agreed. And I think, you know, you just talk about like the whole melting pot of like just all these different people. And I think, you know, we've got a pretty good look at that with the cast of this movie. One person I actually want to call out now, I mean, of course, we'll have to talk about, you know, Dwayne and them, but
how many times have I seen Dwayne in this movie?
His neighbor who is a sex worker, I forget that character's name. It's escaping me.
Is she the one that takes him up to his room and says that story of the little old lady? Or is that the Beverly Bonner who...
Oh, yeah, Casey, the Casey. Beverly Bonner character.
Yes, yes.
Oh, yes, I just pulled it up on IMDb. Yeah, well, and you know what's so cool is, like, I think that was, like, a cool depiction for the time, because, I mean, you could sort of say it's a, maybe sort of a take on the trope of, you know, the hooker with the heart of gold, who, you know, she's not, like, portrayed in this stereotypical just sweet lady way. She's just sort of, like, a nice, friendly, fun-loving person, and she's trying to, like, show this awkward teenager guy a good time.
Yeah, that's what I love about this hotel, because, if you've never seen Basket Case, we're going to spoil the hell out of it, and two, I don't know how to spoil. It's not a movie you can really spoil, because everything I'm going to tell you won't seem believable, but what I love is the fact that
You need to experience Basket Case.
You really do. Dwayne shows up with a basket. Every second question is, what's in the basket? Never tells anyone. But what I love about this flop house or this hotel is that you can tell everyone kind of wants to take care of each other. I mean, you get the hard-ass, I think he's played by Robert Vogel, who's the, like, a dime store Dennis Franz. But he's just this amazing... it's a community. People... from everywhere, they're all just trying to make it through the day, pay their $20 a day, but they all take care of each other. I mean, they're always kind of going, what is going on in that room, are you okay, to Dwayne? Something's going on. And even though he can't tell them that it's Potato Head mutant Belial causing...
Yeah. It's my mutated twin, and we're going to kill all the doctors that separated us.
Exactly. The one's a vet, which I thought was hilarious. Yeah, there's a community, and you do have Casey, who wants to take him out and show him a good time and get to know him and make sure he's okay. And you have, couldn't find her name, but she's the woman who takes him up to his room when he first gets there. And she's telling this amazing story about, you know, little old lady lived in your room, you know, only drove it on Sundays kind of story, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's a fantastic story about how she was hiding from her wealthy family or something. And everyone's got a story. Everyone's very singular. Everyone is kind of in each other's lives. And I love that about this place. I mean, this is a hotel where you don't come to be by yourself. You arrive into a community of its own, a special little diseased, grimy filled community of its own.
Yeah, and let me tell you, $20 a night seemed pricey for that place. It's New York City.
It's in New York City. I'm assuming it's off Times Square, and that would be cheap for Times Square. I mean, you go to Times Square now, it's like $400 a night. Yeah. It's like, flaming heck. But
especially, in the 80s, like, I'm not sure, like, how much inflation has increased it, but it's like, it seems like a lot for a grimy place like that.
Really, I would have thought it would have been $5 a night, personally, but I don't know. They got a thing to run, and it's, I guess, New York City, but...
It's
$20 a night for that place did feel really, really expensive.
So I wanna ask, what did you think of the the character, but moreover the prop of Belial?
I love Belial. I realize he's a psychopathic, psychic mutant half brother potato. But I love the actual effect of him. I like the fact that he's literally a growth that has come out of that's been attached to Dwayne. Like, Dwayne has literally eaten his twin brother in the womb, and so you've just got left as this kind of blob that was literally attached to his waist.
I really feel like my mind is slipping. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that. Yeah, I just love the effect because he does look like something that has been cut off another human being. But he's got obviously a brain and a head, and I love the fact that the effect is literally a mask, literally that a person has to wear on their head, because you do get like the eyes and the facial expressions of this human being, and with the rest of it, it seems so unnatural. It's a really effective special effect.
Okay, yeah, that got me to what I wanted to say. Yeah. I really just two things I want to say is, first of all, I really love when like you can use puppets in a convincing way. I think the 80s was like just the best decade for that, because you had, you know, Gremlins, you had this.
Yeah.
The stop motion isn't great.
No.
Oh, no, it's not. I think they did not have time to do convincing stop motion. Ray Harryhausen, you are not.
No. Ray Harryhausen, you are trying to be, and I know I went on a big rant about movement. This has enough movement, but yeah, he's skipping forward a few steps without...
Yeah, and the way when he throws the drawers and they just sort of like jump cut towards the camera.
It's, yeah, it's, I think it's impressive for $35,000 and literally, because I know in the credits, Hen and Lotta just started making up names for people who, because they only had a very, very small crew. So they just started making up names to fill out the credits to make it look like more people had actually worked on it.
Oh, so really? I didn't hear that part.
Well, I
that's hilarious. I love that.
Yeah. Just to sort of, you know, sort of maybe the five people who were behind the camera, they expanded it out to like maybe 20. It's, yeah, I kind of love the fact that this is kind of what you can do when you don't have much, but at the same time, mm-hmm. no, it's not. I mean, if you look at other stop motion, especially if you look at Ray Harryhausen, it's not that. It's not anywhere close to that. But no, the stop motion isn't great, but I do love how, because you don't see him for a while, and you just see the basket, and he keeps throwing like burger meat and buns into the basket.
Yeah, burgers and hot dogs.
Yes, and it just shakes, and then it just starts spitting out things when he's done. And so you get this kind of sense that something very unnatural is in this thing, and it's, yeah, they work around it quite well, but when they have to really focus in on some of the movement, it doesn't completely work. I think he got a lot better at it in his later movies, especially something like Brain Damaged. But
yeah, you know, this was his first movie.
It, oh, shit, was it?
Yeah.
Wow, this is an amazing first movie then.
I know, especially for $35,000. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, it is literally, it does, it, I mean, something I love about, I love Dark Star by John Carpenter, but that feels like it's a stupid mm-hmm. movie that they've expanded on because they did. This does actually feel like a full movie that has meaning, it has a point, and you can interpret it any which way. Well, not so much, but it's got all those things you want in an actual movie. And the fact that he just said, oh, I'm gonna make my first movie, I've got this much money together, I've got these people, we're just gonna go out and make it, and we're gonna do special effects within that, is kind of incredible.
Oh yeah. Let's see, you know what is funny though is about everyone asking what's in the basket. Now, granted, when the thing like starts growling and shaking, I can understand that, but I feel like walking around New York City in the 80s carrying a basket, that is not the oddest thing people have seen that day.
No, and they keep going, even they're just shouting out to him, what's in the basket? And he just kind of ignores them.
Yeah, it's just like, is this really like, the weirdest thing you've seen in New York City?
Really, like, come on, this is New York City in the early 80s. This is not the weirdest thing you've seen. This is yeah. just way lower the scale of weirdness.
Yeah.
You're right. And then even when he takes it to the different, taking him to the different doctors and everything like that. Yeah. You got the, I mean, I understand, but even when he walks up to the hotel and the guy who runs it, first thing he asks, what's in the basket? It's like, it could be his luggage.
Yeah. Like, his luggage. It's a weird thing to carry luggage in, but again, yeah, not the weirdest thing in New York.
No, it's you. Come on. You run a flop house in early 80s New York. You've seen some shit. You don't. This is not the weirdest. Even Belial probably on the thing is not the weirdest thing you guys have seen.
Yeah, probably not. You mentioned the doctors. I want to ask, did you pick up how very literal the doctors' names were?
No. What were the doctors' names? I missed out on that.
So when you watch the So their names are Dr. Needleman, Dr. Cutter, and Dr. Liplotter, I think. And Dr. Needleman is the guy injecting them. Dr. Cutter is the lady separating them. And Dr. Liflon is the person who's lifting Belial off.
Yes, now that I'm looking actually at the IMD credits, I absolutely see those names and like going, ah, yes, I see what you did there.
Like, man, very creative names there, Frank.
Very creative names. They do their job. But yeah, I love the fact that Diane Brown, who plays Judith Cutter, is a vet. That just, I don't know. What, him sitting in the basket around surrounded by all the animals is one of my favorite images in the movie. I don't know why. I think it's just this kind of in-joke of just what Belial actually is.
Yeah. It's really, also what he is. So I'm really curious, and I was curious. I looked into it. When he's at the bar with Casey, also, the guy's a decent actor for what he's doing. I don't think he acts drunk very well.
Oh, no. It's just more crying and shouting and kind of... No, he needs to go to Jimmy Stewart to learn how to play drunk. Subtly drunk.
Yes, agreed. Yeah. But when he's talking to her and she's like, what's in the basket? It's my brother. And then he's just like, he looks like a squash octopus. I'm like, I mean, sort of, I guess. But apparently, originally, they intended on him having like a tentacle or something.
Oh, that makes sense. I think the way they kind of, that would have been cool. I kind of like the fact that it does look like just a growth. Especially when you see him with actually attached to Dwayne, it does kind of look a bit more bleh. But that like a tumor just kind of on his side. I think that's, it's a little bit more appropriate, but yeah, it's no, I think he's really good. And also I think everyone's really, really great. I know he didn't use professional actors or many professional actors, so everyone's kind of got that same kind of bark quality, but because everyone's in the same boat, it doesn't stand out. So there's no one going, oh, that person's bad or that person's not. Everyone's kind of the same. It's kind of like if you ever watch a John Waters movies when he had like Divine and all his kind of crew, everyone's kind of the same, and you just can kind of sit back and just enjoy the fact that you're watching.
You can sort of put yourself in that world.
Exactly.
Like, this is how people act in this world. Got it.
That's exactly how I wanted to say it. Thank you so much. You can just enjoy, put yourself in this world and go, this is how people act. And I kind of love the performances, especially I do love Casey, the sex worker. She is just, she's got the heart of gold. I feel sorry for her that she had to wake up next to Belial. It's such a funny scene. Oh, dear Lord. And it's just, these people do feel real having to deal with this unreal situation.
Yeah. So what did you think of the death scenes? I did like Dr. Cutter getting the scalpels to the face.
Yes, the death scenes are great. I particularly like the guy who was chopped in half near the end. I thought that was really creative.
Which was their dad, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was their, it was their dad. Yeah, you saw the thing and they just went, all you saw is this like,
let's see how you like being separated.
Oh, poor Dwayne was on a murderous kick right from the beginning. It's Belial, really. It's kind of, I also love the scalpel one, and I not so much, I love his girlfriend who was played by Susan Smith, because that was more the sad one. I do, just because you're like, oh, I like her. I like the fact that her flirtation technique is just to yell at him about the UN building until he goes out with you. I think that's rather sweet.
Weird interaction they had when they first met, and she thought he was like the typewriter repairman.
Oh,
and the way she's just like, it keeps making this sound like, ee.
She's great. I love her. I was so upset. And then what happens to her after she is murdered. But,
and apparently, I was going to mention this earlier, but apparently, did you know that scene caused the entire crew of like four people to walk out on the director?
Oh, that does not surprise me.
Because
he's already done the worst. He's already murdered her. And then you see him slink down and you're like,
yes.
No, he's, oh, Belial.
Like, that's just shock for the sake of, for the sake of shock at that point.
And yes, I did have a trailer that pretty much referenced that exact moment, but it's still kind of shock for the thing moment, but it does make it more grindhouse because you can see this watching this in the movie theater and the whole theater just like going, no.
Yeah.
No, Belial. Naughty Belial.
This is probably not a movie I will pitch to Matt for one of our movie nights. Because sitting and watching that with a person is not for me.
I have not seen this with another person. And that's why I sort of said, when I sort of said, hey, what about Basket Case? I fully expected you to email back going, either one, I haven't seen it, or because not, well, most people who like her, I have seen it, but all this, can we please do something else that doesn't have what this movie has in it?
Nah, outside of that scene, I mean, it's still just a fun, trashy time.
It is a really fun, trashy time. I think it takes it to the nth of trashy, and I like the fact that he doesn't focus in on it a lot, but I can see how people would just go, no, that is too far. You have this Muppet creation, and that is just absolutely a step too far. But everything else about this movie is really fun, even the kills, because they're all inventive. This movie could have been repetitive, because it essentially, Dwayne going after, and Belial going after the doctors who had separated them. It's this revenge thing. And kill after kill after kill. And because the kills are so different and bloody and gory, it just kind of keeps it interesting. It gives it even more texture. Literally, because there's actually quite a bit of blood.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see. Another thing.
Yep, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, another thing, this movie's tone changes a lot. Sometimes I think it's really trying to, like, I feel like Frank Hennenlotter knew, okay, this isn't going to play off pure horror. Let's make this more of a comedic horror scene. And other scenes, he's like, this is going to be a pure horror scene. And then there are just weird moments where Dwayne and Belial have borderline just, you know, real brotherly bonding moments that are sentimental.
They really are. This tone that's totally wildly all over the place, which is why what we were talking about before, I don't think you expect in this movie, because nothing about this movie says that it's going in that kind of dark direction. And you're right, because sometimes it is literally about, which is what I love about Basket Case, because you can see it's funny, it's gory, it's can be a little bit scary, it can be ridiculous, it can be funny, and then you've got these kind of really sweet relationship between these two brothers. But what I love about this movie is that you can kind of see Dwayne pulling away from him once they get to New York, because they've lived out in the small town, they only have each other, there's nothing else to interfere. But as soon as Dwayne and Belial go on their revenge mission, there are places Belial can't go.
Yeah, and also when he starts having his romantic moments with the Terry character, Sharon is her name?
Sharon, I think it's Sharon, yeah.
Belial, through his telepathic connection, becomes like very jealous and belligerent.
Yes, and I love the moment where he gets, like, Sharon's trying to get up. Like, she realizes something is very, very wrong. She's trying to get up off the bed and away from them. But the psychic connection, he's just getting Dwayne to hold her down. And
yes,
it's, and also, and so he's kind of pulling away from him. So every time he does that, that's when Belial goes full kind of thing, no, you're mine, we have this connection, no one else can interfere, which is why I love the kind of the difference between this and Harvey, because Elwood and Harvey,
one of the many
have this kind of thing where their connection opens up the world. It opens up the world in this magical way where everyone's invited. This one is kind of the more sinister version. It's the no, you're mine, not no one else's. So anyone else who comes close to you, I'm going to murder, and anyone in the house who tried to separate us gets murdered. And because Dwayne makes this comment about how when they were connected, or when they were in the same body or connected, they could read each other's thoughts and talk to each other. But once Belial was taken off him, he can't talk to him, but Belial can talk. But Belial can talk to Dwayne. So you've got this kind of interesting power dynamic, which it's kind of these two. Harvey and Elwood and Dwayne are these two lonely guys who don't know how to fit into the world, but because of his Dwayne with his brother and the fact that he cannot leave him because it's his brother, and with Harvey it's because he's kind of, whether he's created or this magical creature's come into his life, whether which way you interpret it, it makes his world better. Belial's just making his life worse, because now he's suddenly realizing, oh, I can have a girlfriend. I can have friends that aren't Belial. And Belial's just sitting there going, you look like a normal person. You can do all these things that I can't. I'm stuck in a goddamn basket. And when you're talking about the brother connection, it really feeds into that. And I think that, so, which is why I think Basket Case has a whole much more going on than just the monster and the horror stuff. It's got that connection of two brothers who are kind of fracturing their relationship in a way.
Yeah, I gotta say, you've really opened my mind to like a whole lot more of a connection. Like I said before, the only connection I saw before was like the secret power. But yeah, the whole like the power and how these, you know, mystical creatures, so to speak, the way they sort of either open up or close off this person's world. Yeah, really interesting connection you made there that I wasn't thinking of.
No, I only saw it when I was sort of watching Basket Case last night, I think it was, the night before, when I was, actually I was sort of watching this when I'm on the work on my own, and then I realized people could see the laptop from coming in. I'm like, should just stop this for a little while, just in case someone's seeing someone disemboweled. but it was, I was sort of watching it, I'm like, oh, Harvey is an opening the world for us. He can take people on these amazing adventures. Belial is a isolating force who just literally just wants to isolate Dwayne from the world because he has no one else. He's this deformed, and you kind of feel sorry for him a little bit, except the fact that he goes way too far with everything.
Yes.
And he is a pure monster and is evil in every respect, but you do feel sorry for him because he knows his link to the outside world, his link to anything is Dwayne.
He can't exist in this world.
He can't exist in this world. He needs Dwayne. And through that, you get the sense that it is mostly Belial probably going for this revenge kind of thing.
The way he was sort of separated, he was just sort of thrown in the trash, like he was nothing.
Yes, and was it their aunt or their grandmother who ended up raising them?
I think the aunt. I can't quite remember.
Because she comes to them and goes, look, I've just saved Belial. I know you two are close. You need to be raised together. And there's that amazing image of her holding Belial, reading to him. And the facial expression on his face is just like, what is that?
It's like Belial himself knows. He's just sort of like, this is really the movie we're making, huh, folks?
Yeah, folks, really? This is what we're doing? All right, okay, I'm just going to sit here, read. All right, okay. You're right. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that's going on, and the tone just keeps changing wildly where you don't necessarily... again, I keep going back to John Waters, but it does have that feeling of, actually, John Waters, you know where you're set. You are going to be grossed out. You are going to be in this kind of bizarre world where you're going to have literally shit thrown at you or rats on the plate or whatever else is happening in those movies. This movie,
it's interesting.
You don't know where you're standing, and it's a really great thing.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you bring up John Waters again, because I believe while this was his first feature film, I think I heard this, that Frank Henenlotter made some short film that played before Pink Flamingo.
Oh, that would absolutely track. I'd need to do a bit of research on that, but that sounds like it's something that would fit, because John Waters is a Baltimore boy, but those two directors have very similar DNA when it comes to... Again, John Waters had more money, which, again, is saying a lot of how much a budget a movie that Basket Case is. But
exactly.
They do have that sensibility of, I want to shock you. Like, again, going back to that dark moment with Belial and Sharon, I can see John Waters pissing himself at that moment. Like, he's just like going, you did it, and I love it, and I didn't even do that. Like, I don't think he has, actually. I haven't seen all his movies.
I want to greenlight those two sequels for you.
Exactly. They've got a really similar DNA, and I kind of love movie making like that, like Larry Cohen, John Waters, Frank Henenlotter, where they don't have much money. They know they're grungy. Yeah. They're going to make it dirty as possible. But they know,
Lloyd Kaufman.
And Lloyd Kaufman, exactly. But they know where to put a camera. Even Roger Corman, to a certain extent. They still know where to exactly put the camera. They know how to cast. They know how to use their special effects almost instinctively. Or Corman just yelling at people that he needs more boobs and then doing something else. But he trained some amazing directors because he gave them no money and he gave them a premise and he let them go for it and make sure there are boobs in there. But that's
yes. That was him. It was Roger Corman. Roger Corman is like a legend in film history in his own right, and just how he launched so many people's careers.
Oh, Demi, I think even Scorsese. I mean, I don't know if he would have made Mean Streets if he hadn't made Boxcar Bertha.
Roger Corman even produced a movie in the 60s that is actually a pretty good psychological horror movie called Dementia 13. That was directed by a young director who was credited in the movie as Francis Coppola.
Oh, we didn't put the Ford in there. Ah.
Not yet.
Too young to have the Ford. It's like when you watch Tales of Bridgemont High and you see and Nicholas Coppola hasn't quite got the cage in there yet.
Instead of Cage, yep.
Yeah. This is my favorite type. Actually, I like many types of movies. Give me, I will still go see a Marvel or DC blockbuster, but I love these types of movies. I love the whole idea of, right, let's get it together. Let's make a genre movie. Let's make it bloody and silly and gross. And it's a blunt hammer at times, but it gets the reactions that they need. And you come up with the most imaginary things. I mean, who would come up with Belial? That is such a devastating creature that you don't want to look at, but you cannot turn away from. I mean, it's disgusting.
Exactly. I gotta give him, like, in an age of like where slashers were dominating the horror genre, this is a real original idea that is like creepy and sort of body horror-ish.
It really, really is. I mean, you're right to bring up the fact that this was 82. You were making slashes. Everyone was making slashes. And then Frank Henenlotter just comes out, nope, I'm going to do my own thing. And it's a mixture of body horror and monster movie is kind of incredible. And the fact that he didn't make it with any money means that he got more control over it than I think if he had investors or more investors than he did. So No, it's a special movie. I'm glad it's made. I think Hendon Lott is still, even though I've heard he's a very polite man, I still think he might be a crazy person judged on brain damage and Frankenhooker. But I think
yes.
movies that he makes are so imaginative and still have meaning to them. He will put stuff in there that you're like, oh, I see what you're doing there. I mean, they are smart. And Basket Case is a really smart movie.
Yes.
Even though it is like the funnest horror movie you've ever seen.
Absolutely. I mean, it's in one thing I forgot to bring up earlier. You know how you were mentioning how, you know, there were no like actual big name actors or anything. You know what's so funny? I noticed, you remember the two like twin nurses?
Oh, yes, yes.
Did you notice one of them had like a cast on? I'm just thinking like, oh, you know, I guess that actress just happened to have a broken arm and they were like, well, you're still in the movie.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
It's just, I mean, little things like that. I'm like, ah, oh, that's fun.
Whatever happens on the day happens on the day. It's yeah, you're right. It's just, it feels like a thing of real life in New York. I mean, Belial fits into New York 1982, just normal. Like every time everyone gets weirded out by him, I'm like, but he is kind of New York in 1982. He is this kind of ugly, gross kind of thing that you have a little bit of sympathy for, but it's kind of before, yeah, it's before New York got polished and is the creature that it is now, which I think is very different to what this movie is.
I'm getting this image in my head of Belial wearing like sunglasses and a misshapen t-shirt saying I heart New York.
I really hope he got an I heart New York, or or my twin brother went to New York and all I got was a stupid t-shirt.
Was this great? Yeah. Perfect. I love it. Maybe he's wearing that shirt and he's waving a flag that says I heart New York.
Yes, yes, exactly. Because when I went to New York, I got a hoodie that said New York on it, and I was not ashamed until the person working at the bar goes, oh, you got a New York hoodie? I'm like, yeah, I was by the harbor. I was cold. And I was like, no, I hunted that thing down. I try to save face. I mean, I was in Brooklyn. I was trying to save face, but at the same time, I'm like, no, God damn it! I chased down a guy with a cart, and I went, I want that hoodie. It says New York.
I've never been to New York City, actually.
I liked it. Yeah, I've only been there once. It was a glorious 5 days of just me walking everywhere and me and my partner pointing at buildings, or Dan just goes, "You recognize that?" I'm like, I do recognize that. That kind of
my most. Thing. My most recent trip actually was up to Philadelphia. We went there because, you know, huge Rocky fan, and
yes.
Yeah, took a picture of like all the different like Rocky locations, and then yeah, went to like the Betsy Ross house and all that stuff.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I had the flu when I was in Philadelphia, but I did go see the Rocky, and then I did this plan of like, I'm gonna run up the steps, saw the steps and went, no. So I had to go back and run up the steps.
Yes. Well, you know, it's funny. I did it, and I feel like under normal circumstances, I would have, like, tired out and quit halfway, but it's, like, it's the Rocky Steps, and I, like, powered through it because of that.
You could see people running up and down them, which was hilarious, because it's the Rocky Steps and to the art museum, and you have to run up them. But, no, I love the fact that Philadelphia has a Rocky statue. It makes me happy. It's just like, yep,
oh, that's your boy. Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm 100%, and like I said, that's my second favorite movie of all time. But yeah, no, Basket Case was.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. No,
I was
sorry.
Say,
go ahead.
I can see why Harvey and Rocky are your two favorite highest movies. As Matt mentioned on that particular film feed show, which I totally recommend going back and listen to their favorites episode. But there is a definite outsider element to your favorites, and I love that it's Rocky and it's Harvey that are at number one.
if you expand that to my top 20, it's like I've got, you know, Amadeus is on there, just a ton of like outsider stories are in that lineup, and yeah. I swear to God, I didn't do it on purpose.
Both you and Matt had very distinctive things. I haven't gone back and listened to Matt's one, but I remember there were two distinctive things that sort of came up between in your favorites. So, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was trying to remember. I know his whole lineup was like Pulp Fiction, Aliens, Back to the Future, and
Ghostbusters.
Ghostbusters was there? Oh, what was the last? I can't remember the last one, but.
Matt,
anyway,
what was your top five if you're listening?
But yeah, this was a ton of fun, Lindsay. I so appreciate you bringing me on for this double.
It really was. Thank you so much for coming on and saying thank you so much to Yetz for watching Basket Case and coming in to talk about and introducing me to the wonderful Harvey and Alwood. That is a joy completely. And this was a great double to talk about. Before we go, is there anything you want to say you've got coming up? If you've got any upcoming Film Feast shows, or do we need to hassle Matt to get you back on?
I mean, I'll be back on fairly soon, I believe. But once again, not on Twitter, everyone. I keep being told I'm probably making the right decision there.
You are making the right decision.
I'm making the right decision, but I still haven't done a ton on there. But on Letterboxd, if you want to follow me, it's Elwood Balboa 92. And yeah, thank you so much for having me on again, Lindsay. This was a ton of fun.
This really wasn't. Thank you for coming on. And if you haven't listened to Film Feast's Suicide Squad episode that just released a couple of weeks ago, especially maybe a few weeks ago time this drops, please give that a listen. It was a huge ton of fun episode with you and Mark and Matt, which was just a joy to listen to. It's like its own little squad together talking about the Suicide Squad. So definitely give that a listen on the Film Feast podcast. If you want to follow Shock and Awe, we're on all the apps, Twitter and Instagram, which I probably spend way too much time on now that I have this podcast. But that's Shock and Awe 1 on Instagram and Twitter. If you want to follow me, I'm on Reading Geek at Twitter. Again, thank you, Ken, for coming on. This was an amazing, I've been looking forward to this. This has been absolutely amazing. And we will be back next week for another double feature. All right, okay, bye, guys.